Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Very, very rewarding. Meeting some fascinating people who on the face of it were quite dangerous and had done some horrible things. But if you dealt with them as human beings, they were actually very, very ordinary. And they're just protecting their interests in a rather brutal way. And it reassured me that even the worst people with the worst reputations have a good side to them, which, of course, I think Helmin quite good said later on, because it means that if you play to people's worst angle, then you'll get the worst from them. But if you play to the best, you'll get the best from them.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Guy Deacon. Guy is a retired army officer who, towards the end of his career, was diagnosed with Parkinson's. With a healthy mix of personal lust for adventure and awareness-raising altruism, in 2019, Guy left his home in Dorset, England, to drive solo overland to Cape Town in South Africa. I've heard it said quite a few times before that overlanding isn't really all that adventurous, and the actual term is just road tripping. But I couldn't disagree with that sentiment anymore. As you'll hear from Guy's story, it's rarely as simple as just setting off, filling your vehicle with fuel every now and again, and driving until you get somewhere. Couple the realities of overlanding with Parkinson's disease, and you have the makings of a very serious, difficult expedition. Guy's journey was racked with issues and problems, not limited to breakdowns, visa issues, and a small thing called COVID-19, but despite all this, and living with the reality of Parkinson's disease, Guy just kept going. In this episode, we talk about Guy's early life and military career, before moving on to understanding Parkinson's, what it really is and how it affects people. And naturally, we then move on to have a conversation about Guy's overland expedition and the highs, lows, trips and stumbles that came with it. I also want to very briefly mention we've now launched the Adventure Podcast Plus, where free subscribers get access to a newsletter that features links, insights and opinions on the world of adventure and exploration. Paid subscribers get access to a whole load of new bonus content, including a monthly Q&A with a guest, access to filmed InVision podcasts, access to our shorter form podcast, The Dispatches, and subscriber-only posts and articles. To get involved, head to theadventurepodcast.substack.com. And finally, before we start, I'll just give a huge shout out to the Martin Moran Foundation, our charitable partner, who help people from disadvantaged backgrounds get outdoors, upskill, and fall in love with mountains. If you're in a position to, please consider donating to the foundation.
Okay, over to Guy Deacon.
Where do you want to begin?
Where do I want to begin, Guy? Well, I think it would be great. We'll start at the start. If you could introduce yourself and tell me who you are and what you do, whatever that means to you.
Right, okay, that's fairly straightforward. I'm a fairly ordinary bloke. I was in the army for 30-odd years, so I had a full career of doing one job, which is unusual as well nowadays. Retired in 2019, and because I've got Parkinson's, couldn't go and find another job to do, so I thought, what do I do with my time? Had this lingering dream and wish to go and travel across Africa ever since I was at school. So I went off and did it. And I'm now living in Dorset, telling a story about it, making sure as much people know about it as possible, because I used it as a vehicle to raise awareness for Parkinson's disease, which I've got.
I think if you're comfortable with doing so, which it sounds like you are, given your kind of mission and purpose these days, let's talk a little bit about Parkinson's. And I think actually, you know, specifically what it is.
Right, well, people think they know about Parkinson's, but I don't think they always do. They think there's one disease called Parkinson's, and there's not. There's a range of options to choose from. It's like a menu. You can have whichever bits you want. And they all have Parkinsonian features and characteristics. So we're all a little bit different. But the long and short of it is we're missing dopamine, which is an important ingredient to make our nervous system work properly. So we have all the messages lurking in our brain, and we send them down our nervous system, but they don't actually get to where they need to be. So we don't have quite the right amount of control over your body as you need. and it's very debilitating. It doesn't kill you. They say it doesn't kill you. I suppose it would eventually. But gradually you become less and less capable of doing things, and everything becomes more and more difficult and frustrating. But it can last a very long time. The good news is there are some quite good drugs out and about which have been around for a while now, which make a big difference. And I use levodopa primarily, and I take a lot of tablets, and they make a heck of a difference. And when I'm on pills, I'm almost normal. When I'm not, I'm good for nothing. The difference is that stark. So you can carry on reasonably normally if you want to and try hard enough. The reality, of course, about Parkinson's is that the dopamine, or lack of it, has other effects as well. It has mental effects. It affects the way you feel. It affects the way you behave and interact with people, all these things as well, which are not really talked about. We all know about the physical side of it, the stumbling and the tripping and the mumbling and the dribbling, all that sort of stuff. But very few people know what's going on in our heads, because it's dopamine is really important to keep your mood sort of level and right and all that sort of stuff, which people tend to forget about or don't even know about.
Yeah, I mean, you've touched on it there and given us a really kind of broad brush explanation of what it is. But what are the physical, you know, I think, as you say, we've all sort of seen somebody with Parkinson's or seen the movies. You know, what are the physical implications of having Parkinson's and living with it?
There are two primary main types. There's bradykinesis and discokinesis, or something like that. The disco is where you move around and you shake, and that's what people are most familiar with, where you can't stand still and you're always moving, your legs are jittering, your arms are shaking, your head wobbles around from side to side. And that's a very demeaning sort of way to have it, because it's a very difficult way to sort of live. I have completely the opposite. I'm very static and very still. So I actually can't move sometimes. I freeze and I can't move my legs. So if I get stuck in a corner, I have to sort of literally work out how I'm going to move out. And every sort of thing that I need to do, I need to think carefully about, because my muscles just don't respond to what I do. So I'm very, very static all the time. And that's fairly obvious when you know what to look for. But it means that I can't pick things up, and I can't move a mouse to get my computer to work. I can't rattle a keyboard. I can't write. I can't pick up a cup of tea without having difficulty. All these things can be very, very difficult. And it affects every single thing you do, from getting out of bed in the morning to getting dressed to going and showering and cleaning your teeth, all that sort of stuff. And eventually it becomes almost too much of a trial. It's very, very tiring to do. And then by the time you've got to do anything important, you're sort of rather stressed out. And stress, in my experience, is a real sort of, well, it just makes it much worse. I respond very badly to stress. So everything I do, I try and keep as much time as I can. And I try and be as relaxed as possible, because if I get unrelaxed, then my condition just gets worse and I become even more useless.
Well, I get the sense that, you know, this conversation probably appropriately and based on where we both want to go with it will be dominated by the Africa journey and Parkinson's as well. But I think it would be useful to give us some context around, you know, not your childhood in detail necessarily, but what made you want to join the army and what was your career like there? What did you do specifically?
I was never really thinking about anything else, actually. I assumed I'd join the army. My father was in the army. I didn't think I want to be in the army and to give it any deliberate thought. I just drifted along merrily on that route, and I always thought I would. And I wasn't actively encouraged by my father, but it was pretty clear in retrospect that actually all the doors were open for me to do so, and everything was laid out in a way that I just followed meaninglessly. If I'd failed to get in, I don't know what I would have done. I didn't have any dreams to be a fire engine driver or a policeman or anything like that. I always saw myself being a soldier, and I was. And I joined a regiment called the Queen's Dragoon Guards, which is equipped with tanks and armoured cars and things, and spent, as I say, my entire career with that regiment. But most of the time, of course, you spend doing other jobs away in the army in various places. And I had a very active life, doing all sorts of fantastic jobs in fantastic places, which sort of fueled my desire and interest in travelling abroad and seeing the world. So I was very lucky in that respect.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I have a sort of slight fascination with the armed forces and that life. And we've interviewed a lot of ex-soldiers on the podcast. And I think there's sometimes this misconception of what life as a soldier is like. You know, I understand you were an officer, but I don't think it's just, you know, sitting in a barracks, counting bullets in Britain, waiting for a war and heading off to Afghanistan. You know, what were you doing and how did that fuel this kind of need or want for adventure?
On a routine basis, as a young officer, you are given lots of responsibility, which is to look after the people in your troop or platoon or whatever it happens to be. I had a troop of 12 people, all of whom were more experienced than I was, but in theory didn't have the leadership that I had. that's not necessarily the case. It's just that it's been identified in me earlier, and I've been lucky enough to go to Santos. It so happens that some soldiers are brilliant. They just don't know that the doors are there to open if they try. And the army is quite good at identifying these people and saying, look, you, there's more to you than meets the eye, old chap. Go off and do this course, and you might come back as an officer. And we're quite good at that. So on a routine basis, you're looking after these people on their administration, making sure everything's fine and dandy. And we used to have our own vehicle, so the tanks used to take a lot of tinkering with. So we spent a lot of time working on the engines and getting covered in oil and preparing them to make sure they worked all the time. Because at that stage, we were facing the Russian and the Warsaw Pact, of course. And so, and it's hard to believe now, it was genuinely possible for the whole regiment to drive out of the gate in a two-hour period and get to our crash-out positions in Germany, which was where we were based at the time, ready for the war to begin, because that was the aim. Every single vehicle, every single bit of kit could drive out within 2 hours. And it wasn't just my regiment. It was all the regiments in Germany. And now we can't even get one squadron to Germany from here without getting excited about it. But then the whole army could move in 2 hours. It was extraordinary, really. But to do that required a lot of work at home, a lot of maintenance, a lot of preparation of kit and all that sort of stuff. But there was lots of opportunity as well to have fun and to keep people interested and to keep soldiers on the go. So there's lots of sport, lots of adventurous training, lots of skiing in the winter, lots of windsurfing and sailing in the summer, all of which was designed to keep people interested and to develop their leadership skills and their sense of adventure, because you want these people to go and take all sorts of risks in war. And the best way is to train them in taking risks in peace in a safe condition.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. It doesn't sound like the worst lifestyle in the world.
It's fantastic, and I loved it. Of course, my entire career was not spent with the Queen's Young Guards. I went away and did staff jobs of various sorts, two or three of which were quite unusual. For example, I spent a year in Belize, Central America, which was absolutely fabulous. I spent 3 or 4 months in Mauritius at one point, training the Mauritian army how to map read, which was remarkable. I spent time in the Congo later, a year and a half, disarming rebels with the UN. I spent time in Kuwait, and I spent time in Batters training. So I went all over the place, really. And importantly, because I had this sort of this adventurous bug in me, I organized a couple of expeditions taking soldiers to Africa. And on one particular occasion, took 12 soldiers from in a truck and a Land Rover from the UK to Kenya overland, all of which was not just for free, but we were being paid to do it, of course.
And I would like to talk a little bit about the Congo, just because I think interesting is maybe the wrong word, but it's, you know, regularly see it in the news. It's a place that has been kind of devastated by infighting, rebellion, etc. And it's somewhere, you know, I don't want to make this conversation about me at all, but it's somewhere I worked extensively early on in my career with cameras in my hands near Goma and Bukavu. And I just want to understand what your experience was like being there and what the job actually literally involved.
I don't know when you were in Goma. I was in Goma as well for 18 months. And that was in 2010 I was there.
I think I was there in 2010, 11.
Really?
Yeah.
You were probably staying in the Hoosie Hotel, weren't you?
I can't remember the name of it. We were in Bukavu a lot and travelling up the road to Goma. Yeah.
Traveling up the road to Goma, in those 4 or 5 words, you describe a journey which is almost impossible, of course.
Yeah, very scary, scary time. I've talked about that in another podcast, but I stopped doing that work after a run-in with some heavily armed people on the road to Goma. And I just thought, I think I'm done with this now. I'm 21 years old. I haven't had any formal training. I don't really think I should be here.
I was very lucky. I never felt threatened at all when I was in Goma or travelling around about. For the first 6 months, my job was as a military officer. I was the deputy chief of staff for a chap called General Babacar Gaye, who you might remember the name because he was the UN man in charge at the time and quite a big sort of person in that part of the world, and a really good man too. Senegalese, very French, not terribly pro-British, but actually warm to us because we were not too bad at doing our job. Very few of us there. Anyway, I would act on his behalf in the East and Goma and run a little headquarters for him when he would arrive out. And I worked very closely with the Indian and the Pakistani brigades, who I got on very well with because, of course, we have an affinity for our histories, our joint histories together. And the brigadiers and I got on famously, and we used to talk about the old days, and it was good fun. But, of course, the Indians and the Pakistanis wouldn't necessarily talk to each other in the same way because they have this problem in Kashmir, and the problem was manifesting itself in Congo as well a bit because the border between Pakistani area of responsibility and the and the Indian area of responsibility was right down the middle, placed through a place called Hombo, which you may have heard of. And Hombo is not a million miles from Bukavu, where there were two massacres in particular. The first, the UN couldn't do anything about because they couldn't get there. The second, and I write about this in my book, I decided, rather inadvertently, to send some Pakistani troops into the Indian area of responsibility to go and sort of sort out what was happening. And I did this in consultation with the two brigade commanders, but they said they couldn't talk to each other because of the political problems at home. But if they were ordered to do it, then that would be all right. So with their consultation, I wrote an order which allowed the Pakistanis across the border into the Indian area of responsibility and go and find out what was happening, which is the right thing to do. But of course, it was very sensitive, and I got into big trouble with Papa Gagai because I was deploying troops on his behalf, which, of course, is what we're trying to do in the UK all the time. We act with responsibility and trying to get things wrong, and not necessarily the case in the UN.
That's fascinating. I think we could talk about that for a very long time, but maybe shouldn't.
The other thing I just want to talk about very slightly about Congo, the second half and the third half, if that makes sense. I did three six-month tours, effectively. And the second and third were spent disarming rebels. So I spent a lot of time with the various groups on the FDLR in particular, who were all hiding in the Congo from the spillover from the genocide in Rwanda. And I spent a lot of time with fascinating people, ex-rebels who are helping me do it, some who are busy trying to volunteer to come and hand themselves in, and closely involved in the work the British were engaged in to try and get these people to hand themselves in. It was an extraordinary work, very, very rewarding, meeting some fascinating people who on the face of it were quite dangerous and had done some horrible things. But if you dealt with them as human beings, they were actually very, very ordinary, and they're just protecting their interests in a rather brutal way. And it reassured me that even the worst people with the worst reputations have a good side to them, which, of course, I think held me in quite good stead later on, because it means that if you play to people's worst angle, then you'll get the worst from them. But if you play to the best, you'll get the best from them. And as a result, I never had any problems in Africa at all.
I think that I'm wary of getting too political, and I often say, you know, if people disagree, they're welcome to email and get grumpy with me. But I do completely agree with you. I think, you know, I would never dream of excusing any of these, you know, atrocious actions of these people. But some of these things are circumstantial and based on upbringing and situation. And, you know, I think we all like to think often in our little Western bubble that we wouldn't behave like that. But I think the reality is, if we were brought up in that way, in that world, at that time, we would probably be exactly the same and believe exactly the same things. And
I'm sure you're right. You're right. And even the worst groups, all they're doing is they're protecting their own interests.
Yeah. It's a complicated issue. But
it's very complicated. And it's not going to be solved overnight either.
Yeah. Or anytime soon. Yeah. So obviously, you, as you said, you ultimately left the army. Was that because it was time and you'd done everything you needed to do, or was that
you normally retire at the age of 55, and I was 58 when I left the army, because first of all, I had an extra couple of years because I was lucky enough to be a graduate, so you could extend your commission slightly. And then when I was doing my last job down in Bovington in Dorset, which is a job I loved doing for the Royal Armoured Corps, I miraculously couldn't replace myself. There was nobody to replace me, so I said, oh, all right, I'll do another year then, which was just as well, because I wasn't really ready to leave. I'd been so engrossed in what I was doing, I didn't really think about the future at all and kind of ignored it. I sort of assumed it wouldn't really happen to me. So if I'd left when I was supposed to live, I would have been out and about thinking, what do I do next? But I had that extra year to sort of think, I need to concentrate now on what I want to do and really focus on it and make sure I'm ready for it. And most people would use that time to find a job and to find a house and to all that sort of business. But I was lucky that we had a house and my wife worked, but unlucky that I knew I wouldn't be able to get a proper job because I couldn't hold one down. There are people in my condition who don't have any jobs at all. I was very lucky to have been paid by the army as long as I was. But I was going to undertake this trip, and that meant that I could focus on it properly with a view to making that my job, if you like, my raison d'etre. And it became everything to me, really. It became my sinecure, my purpose, my focus, and everything.
And before we start talking about Africa and what happened and how it all got planned, did you retiring from the army coincide with the Parkinson's diagnosis, or was there a gap?
No, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's when I came back from the Congo. So in 2010 or 2011, whatever date it was, I think in 2010. And of course, I didn't know I had it, but there are certain things which weren't quite right. The first thing was my right arm would hover at sort of waist height while I was cleaning my teeth, and sort of at no particular reason it would be hovering, and I wonder what it was doing there. Really insignificant, but just a bit strange. Secondly, I couldn't turn pages over in my book when I was reading in bed, and I thought, why is my right hand not working properly? And I assumed I'd been bitten by something or trapped a nerve or whatever. But I just couldn't quite do that. Thirdly, I would stumble a trip, and my right leg would drag on the ground a bit, and I assumed, you know what Goma is like with all that volcanic rock everywhere. I assumed it was the ground, and it was just tripping me up. I couldn't understand why it was on my right side, but I assumed it was just the ground. That's the way it was. And then, bizarrely, I couldn't put my right hand in my pocket, and I thought, well, that's ridiculous. My trousers aren't right. It wasn't my fault, obviously. There was something wrong with my trousers, because I couldn't put my hand in my pocket and get things out, which is really ridiculous. And then on top of that, I found myself emotionally in a different position as well. And if I read any books that were remotely emotional, such as the Poisonwood Bible, which is a fantastic book, which I'm sure you've read, had me in tears. If you haven't read it, you've got to read it. It's about the Congo as well in the 1960s.
Writing.
It's an amazing book. Poisonwood Bible by somebody called Kingsover, I think. It's a great read. And a Shake Hands with the Devil by the Canadian general, which I'm sure you've read.
Yeah, I've had read that.
I could just imagine his frustration and the awful situation he was in. And I couldn't control my emotions. I was in bits. It was pathetic, which is quite unlike me. So all these things were going on, and I didn't put two and two together, or four and four, or five and five. I just thought it was just the way that it was. But I arrived back much different, worn out, exhausted and tired. And everybody thought, blimey, you're not quite right, old chap. And I thought, well, I'll go and see the doctor if I have to. And they took me to the doctor about a minute and a half to think there was something wrong with me. And I was sent off to go see a neurologist. And the neurologist took about 10 seconds to diagnose me, because it's so obvious when you know what to look for. So obvious.
Yeah. And so you stayed in the army with Parkinson's for some time.
Yeah, so I was on leave, having returned from the Congo, and that's when I was diagnosed. And the first thing I did was ring up my future employer, because I was about to go and take on a new job up in Edinburgh as the chief of staff of the 2nd Division up there. And so I rang up the general and said, General, I'm just about to send you a letter reporting for duty and this sort of stuff, but I think I need to tell you and warn you that I've just been diagnosed with Parkinson's, not sure what to expect. And he said, well, don't worry, that's absolutely fine. You do what you can do, and we'll look after you. There's plenty of room. We've got other people with other problems. I'm sure your problems are quite manageable. We'll carry on as if nothing happened. And from that moment on, the army carried on being the best employer it could possibly be. I was paid the same amount of money as everybody else. Certain things I couldn't do, and I relied upon people a bit more than others, perhaps. I couldn't deploy on operations anymore because of the tablets and the pills and that sort of stuff. But I got my choice of jobs. I worked in personnel. I did the best job I have ever done in Bovington at the end of my time, and had an extra year in the army and got a CBE as a result of it.
I mean, that is amazing, isn't it? In some senses, I would never have guessed.
I can't speak highly enough of the system, you know. But they look after people incredibly well, and I am an example of that. And I couldn't speak more highly for the care I got.
And one thing I'm fascinated by and often talk to people about specifically related to expeditions is this whole idea of coming home. I think it's something we don't talk about enough, and kind of the post-expedition blues, as it were, which, you know, does ring true for a lot of people. I think for people who have spent the majority of their life in the armed forces, that departure, and this is something I've spoken to people about before, is it can be profound. You know, it's that institutionalized, the nature of life, and then suddenly you're not there anymore. I know you had your Africa trip in your head, but how did you react to suddenly not being a soldier anymore?
The trip wasn't in my head. I had left the army. I was on the road within 4 weeks.
Okay, well that's a good coping strategy.
Yeah, seriously, I was hightailing it. I was off. I was on my way. Because otherwise I would have just drifted along merrily, and I would have been on the scrap heap in no time, because I am the product of the institution. You know, I've been looked after and serving an organization that looked after people very well. And I paid my part in looking after other people very well. And suddenly you're at home and your wife gets cross with you because you're sitting around doing nothing and you're not looking for a job, whatever it happens to be. And you're busy doing things that you shouldn't be busy doing, such as emptying the bins and all this sort of stuff. all the admin, which you don't realize me going on behind your back all the time. And you're busy just achieving nothing in a funny way, apart from just living normally. And it's very, it's a sharp contrast to where you've been before. So that's another reason that why the trip was so important to me. It gave me a very clear sense of purpose.
Yeah. And I think that, again, that's something that we'll come back to, but you said it was a kind of childhood or young adulthood dream to go and travel through Africa. At what stage did you decide you were going to do it? And how did you commit?
Right. The first thing was I received a book through the post, and I haven't got it in this room. It was a Wexus. You might remember the company called Wexus. They did travels sort of with guides and goodness knows what. And Wexus produced this book, which I somehow got by applying for something in the 1970s online. Well, it wouldn't have been online, but I sent off a book for free or whatever for joining a travel newspaper organization or something. And this book had a most extraordinary cover on it. It had some pictures of Land Rovers in the desert with the setting sun behind them, people clambering around, unloading kit and everything. I thought, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And I'll do it in the army, and I want to use my time in the army to get around the world and to go to places that nobody else goes and explore all these fantastic places. That and a picture history book with pictures of the desert in the old days and the romance of Africa and everything, which isn't necessarily quite true, but you know what I mean. It draws you. So I had this, and that was from the age of sort of 17 onwards. I thought, that's what I want to do. I knew I wouldn't get the chance to do it very easily unless I joined the army and was lucky enough to be deployed to various places, and I was. But I was really blessed at Durham when I went to university. The first night that I was there, I met a chap who was more adventurous than me, had done more than I'd even dreamt of doing, and we that very first night said, let's go and do a trip to Kenya. Have you been to Lake Turkana?
No.
Lake Turkana is in the north of Kenya, up in the northern frontier district, and it's very hot and very deserty and very appealing. And the lake is like, it's called the Jade Sea, and is very, it sort of taunts you, it drags you north, it's great. And so he and I went up there to go and look at the Turkana tribes people and study their material culture. And that's what we did, and it was fantastic. So that sort of convinced me that you didn't have to be that clever, or you could organize yourself to undertake trips from university, but and you could get sponsorship and you could find a purpose and you could find a reason to do it, and it was all possible. So as a result of that, I then sort of developed the ability to do these things. I then went on a trip from Durham with some of those three-wheel quad, well, they weren't quads, they were three-wheelers, you know, the Honda Big Red bike type things, with two Range Rovers and a Unimog with some friends from Durham, and we went across a bit of the desert in Algeria, which was absolutely fantastic. And we were all 21, 22 years old, seven of us, ruled the world. Nothing could stop us. We were going to a place where nobody had ever been before. We knew better than everybody else because we were experts, which, of course, we weren't. We had this extraordinary naive confidence that we wouldn't have any problems. And that was the thing at the time. If you have this not arrogance, but supreme confidence that you can just do it, and you have the wherewithal to do it, and you're lucky enough to fall in with people who've got the right spirit, sense, and attitude, and it's amazing what you can achieve. You just have to say yes and get off your ass and do it. And it's too easy to say, oh, it's a bit tricky, it's a bit dangerous, it's all this and that and the other. It's too easy to say no. But I fell in with a bunch of people who said, yes, let's just do it. Before I knew it, I was finding myself doing these things. And I had a bit of a reputation when I arrived in the army because I'd done all these things, and I was keen to make sure they knew that, because that would make me more attractive to get in. And of course, the regiment was quite keen to take soldiers to Africa. And I said, yep, I'll take them. I'll show them around. I'll show them what to do. And lo and behold, that ended up in that trip with the four-tonner and the Land Rover driving down to Kenya. And I then subsequently took another trip with some troopers back to Kenya to walk up to Lake Turkana through the Marsabit and Chalbi Desert and everything. And it was all possible. And I applied for jobs around the world, which were other people didn't want to go to, in Kuwait, in Belize, places like that, and I loved it to bits.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds amazing. And so off the back of that, you know, I think there is a difference between applying for roles inside the armed forces and then suddenly deciding, well, I'm going to go and do this thing, and I'm going to go and do it by myself on my terms. It's about me.
Yes, well, that's I think two or three things. First of all, I couldn't expect anybody to spend that much time traveling because they didn't necessarily have the time and they didn't have the, they had commitments at home and goodness says what. So I was quite happy for people to come and join me. But the thing about Parkinson's is you become quite selfish and there's you need a bit of looking after and you're very conscious about your you're imposing on other people. And so I'm quite happy in my own company. And by just trundling down through the desert by yourself, was kind of gave me a freedom to do what I wanted in the slow time I needed to. I didn't have to react to anybody else. There's no pressure to be wearing a suit and going and seeing something. No pressure to go and do things I didn't want to do. I was in control of my simple little life, and it was all about simplicity really, and reducing anything that just makes life complicated. So that's why traveling by myself was the original idea. Although I was very happy to come and visit me for a period of time. And spend time because it's quite nice to be able to laugh and have a chat with people, you know, on a routine basis. So, but it was difficult for people to come out and meet me because I was never quite sure where I was going to be, and meeting timetables and being in an airport at a certain time is really hard work. So it becomes more of a challenge to be there in the right place and then you've got to entertain them because they've spent all this money flying out to join you. You're responsible for their good holiday.
So where did it all start and when and with what vehicle and how did you acquire it, etc.?
Right. Going back to this trip when I drove across the desert with the Army of Bedford and Land Rover, at the same time, there was an American couple who were doing the same sort of trip across the Sahara and they were driving a VW camper van and it looked completely normal. And I then discovered it wasn't normal at all. It was a four-wheel drive one, which you may be familiar with, a thing called a Synchro. And I thought to myself, that is very cool. It looks normal, it can go anywhere, and it's got everything you need in it. And they're having a great time. And I thought, that's really, really what I want to do when I grow up. And I went to New Zealand for a very short period of time. And we hired one of these things with this friend who I'd done trips with before. And I thought, when I go back to the UK, with the money I've saved in the Congo, I'm going to buy one of these 4x4 camper vans and get to use it and trot around Scotland and all the rest of it. So I bought one. I thought, that's a fantastic, perfect vehicle. And I'm quite mechanically minded. So I quite enjoy tinkering with things. And you think you're improving them, but you never are improving them. And why should I be any better than Mr. VW and make his car better? But you think you are. So I did. So I had this car, which I would spend a lot of time tinkering with. But unfortunately, it wasn't quite reliable enough to take on a proper trip, although I would love to have done. So we chopped that in and I got a modern version of it, which the family can use and because it works and there are no special ways of making it work. And it's a four-wheel drive VW camper van T5.1, which was almost all right to undertake the journey. I had some bits and pieces done to it. A chap called Rob Willis at Volkstrek helped me improve the suspension, put some Under Armour underneath it and some various bits and pieces to just make it more capable of doing the job. And that was what we did. I then did a few things inside to improve things, to make it more suitable for me, loaded up with stuff and drove off. Almost as simple as that.
I think that's one of the most interesting parts about trips like this is, you know, it would probably be worth you talking us through the top line plan. You know, where were you starting? Where were you going? But it's that whole idea of, well, you just get in the car and go.
The biggest thing of all is to book your first ferry ticket because that sort of that defines things. And it's very easy not to. You think, well, I'm not quite ready yet. I've got to do a bit of this, got to tinker with that, got to get my paperwork sorted out. If when you book your ticket, then you're going and there's no discussion about it. So that was quite an important sort of deliberate act I had to do. And I ended up going from, I'm going to say Whitehaven, which is on the south coast, to Dieppe, which is because it was cheap. And I was save good money and I was going to drift down through France, going to stay with a mate and enjoy going through Europe because it was winter at the time and I was in no rush. At the time, my ambition was to get as far as Sierra Leone and decide what to do when I got there. And the reason for that was twofold. One, because I knew about Sierra Leone, we had British troops there and I thought I could go and knock on the door and say, hi, I've just retired, can you help me out if I had a problem? And I thought I might be able to ship the truck back on a Hercules or a ship or something, naively. And secondly, a friend had just done it on a motorbike, so I knew roughly what the route and the journey was. And it would cover the best parts of Africa, in my view, which are the clean deserts and sand and the Sahel and all that sort of wonderful sort of space where you have acres and acres and acres of space, miles of space, beautiful sand dunes, and not too many people. So you're reasonably secure and reasonably comfortable. So that was what I was going to do. And the journey went pretty well until I got to Andorra, where I had the first breakdown. More about all those later on. But I was getting, the aim was to get to Sierra Leone, and before I got, shortly before I got there, I decided what to do next. And as I got there, I had a few sort of moments with Parkinson's, but nothing dramatic. But I realised that actually I was enjoying what I was doing. I didn't really want to rush back to the UK. I didn't have anything I wanted to do. There was no job crying out. Tanya was happy working. We were settled where we were, and I thought, well, I might as well make the most of this, because I'd also gathered a bit of a following on Polar Steps, which is a brilliant website application for your phone. Can't speak highly enough about it. And people were interested in what I was doing. So I thought, well, let's carry on going, because I'd set a small goal, which was to use this trip as a vehicle to show people back in the UK, not anywhere else, that just because you've got Parkinson's doesn't mean to say you can't do things. You can still live your dream. You can still do things. You might have to do things a bit differently, but don't give up, because it's very easy to give up and just to literally turn yourself into a ball and not do anything at all. And you've got to get off your ass and do things. So I wanted people to see me doing this and to realize that if I could do this, then they could probably go and have a round of golf, or they could take the dog for a walk, or they go to the cinema, whatever it happens to be. They can achieve their aims if they want. Mine was perhaps a bit ambitious, but that was the aim of it. And I had a bit of a following by the time I got to Sierra Leone. I thought, well, let's carry on the motion. Let's keep going. Knowing full well that from Sierra Leone round to Angola was going to be quite tricky. And I looked at various options, such as getting a boat across the Bight of Benin and all the rest of it. But eventually I thought, well, I'm going to do this full time and just kick on with it. But of course, then COVID came and everything sort of fell a bit flat. And I couldn't go any further at that point.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, I think that's where I was going to go with this. So when did you leave, month and year?
I left November 2019.
Okay, yeah, so that does give us some context. And you know, you talk about the journey to Sierra Leone. I am personally fascinated by North Africa and the kind of geopolitics of it compared to the adventurous nature of it. And what was your route? Because I think it has a reputation for being a complete no-go zone.
There are normally three ways to Africa. There's the east coast, sort of down Cairo, down follow the Nile down, although Sudan is difficult at the moment, and then down the east coast through all those rather benign Tanzania, Zambia, Zimbabwe, all those countries down South Africa. And that's what people normally used to do, and it was relatively straightforward. There used to be the central route down through Algeria, down to Niger, into Nigeria, across to Cameroon, then across the top of Zaire, as it was, or Congo, and then down and all the rest of it. That's kind of out of bounds because Algeria has been shut for a long time. It is now possible to get there, I'm told, but visas are almost impossible to get, which kind of left the west coast open. And I'd never been down there before, but it used to be the case that Mauritania was impossible, Western Sahara was impossible, and then you had that was before you got into your Guineas and your Sierra Leones and your Liberias and your Ghanas and your all the other really tricky countries. But bizarrely enough, although it's about to change, I have a horrible feeling, The West Coast route was open at the time I wanted to do the journey. And although it's quite tricky in ways I'll describe in a second, I thought, well, let's go for it. Let's go to these countries I've never been to before. Let's see what they're like. My French isn't very good, but it'll be jolly good by the time I finish, I'm sure. And we'll just see what happens. And, you know, being able to drive Morocco has always been fine. Being able to cruise through Western Sahara without a thought in the world was unusual, to say the least. To spend time in Mauritania, which was, you used to have to get an escort to get through there from top to bottom down to Senegal, you could spend as much time there as you wanted. I didn't, as it turns out, because I was by myself. I had a bit of a timetable, and I was very wise. I was a very wise chap and decided not to go in the desert by myself, because I thought I would bump into people doing overlanding all the way south. I never thought I'd be totally alone. In fact, south of Western Sahara, a place called Dakhla, I hardly saw any overlanders at all. They don't go south of Morocco. They go to the desert and they trundle around, and all these Germans and Swiss and their big trucks have a lovely time, but they just don't go further south than that. So I was quite unusual and alone in two respects, not just alone with myself, but I didn't have any company in a second vehicle, which I thought I would find that problems. So I wouldn't go and do anything risky and dangerous, which is a bit disappointing, really. But anyway.
Go on. I know, I just quite like to hear the stories.
Yeah, so I basically hugged the coast all the way around. And Morocco, a friend came out, and we did go into the Ergs, the Chebbi Erg along the Algerian border, which was, have you been there? Beautiful. No. The Drar Valley and that around there. Glorious scenery. Not much sand, not many sand dunes like there is in Algeria, but enough to prove the wagon was fantastic, fantastic. You know, it let the tire pressure down to the right amount, and just drive normally, and I couldn't fault it. Brilliant machine. Not necessarily very well driven all the time, but brilliant machine. And so we had quite a good time in Morocco. I went with the chap I'd been at university with, so we relived all our experiences, which is great. Then I tended to kick on down through into Senegal, which the first place I had to stop and get the next sort of visas. Visas are a proper pain. And my general rule was to go and get them sort out two countries before I needed them. So I would get the ones for Liberia sorted out when I was in Guinea or whatever it would be. So I had a bit of spare time. And invariably, visas come from capital cities. That's where the embassies are, which means you need somewhere to stay. And they're always quite a tricky place to stay. So I was always very keen, if I had any contact at all, I'd ring them up and say, look, I wonder if you can help. I don't want a bed for the night. Can I come and camp in your garden? Because, of course, I could do that. All I need is to hook up some power and some water. But people were always incredibly kind. And I think they were quite interested in the fact that they had a visitor coming at all. And I was treated so well by so many people that I had a very enjoyable time being shown around capital cities I didn't expect to see whilst I waited for my visas to be done.
How long was that process taking? I assume it wasn't a single day.
No, God, no. No, no, no. Visas would generally take a week or 2 weeks and sometimes longer. And of course, if you're applying for two countries, then you've got to do it twice. So it's a question of how much your host can tolerate you. And if I talk about Nigeria, where I ended up later, Nigeria is notoriously a very difficult country to go to. And it's got some very rich, some very poor, and some horrible crime and some horrible things going on there. And it's one of the most dangerous countries to go through, so everybody says. But I was of the view that if I was sensible and didn't have any problem and didn't mess anybody about, said yes and was nice to the police, I'd be all right. And I knew people there. Because I had this website up and running and people were following me a bit, a chap who I hadn't met, an ex-soldier, turned around and said, you will come and stay with me, I will organise everything for you and it will be fantastic and I will look after you. And I thought, all right, that's brilliant. Another chap whose father I knew said, I provide security and I will meet you and I will help you plan your route through Nigeria. So these two, they're both called Tim. They both met me at the border, got me through the border post because they'd been sort of talking to the officials and everything. They provided a driver, an armed escort and a second vehicle. And we then drove to Lagos, which is about a 3-hour drive, where I stayed with Tim in a gated compound because they all are. I got visa sorted out for the next couple of countries and started planning the route and saw, importantly in Nigeria, saw people who have Parkinson's, because I'll talk about that in a minute. I'd arranged to meet up with people with Parkinson's at this stage. And to get out of Nigeria to Cameroon, across the border, Tim organised me to have an armed guard, an escort vehicle and a driver. And they stayed with me for a week. In fact, they took longer than that because I had to get all the way back in. And he did it out of the goodness of his heart because he was taken by the story. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. And I think...
It's completely amazing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the Parkinson's element obviously plays hugely into all of this in terms of your experiences and your ability to deal with situations that arise or arose, but also you know, I noticed, and I'm sure it was deliberate earlier, you said your initial ambition was to raise awareness of Parkinson's in the UK at the time.
Yeah.
When did that change? Because I understand it did.
It did change. It changed very much. Very, very, very much. Because I came back, I was evacuated from Sierra Leone because of COVID. I couldn't go any further, which is not surprising because nobody else could move. So why would I be able to move? In fact, the conditions, there was no COVID in Sierra Leone or anywhere near it at the time, whereas in England or UK and Italy were having real trouble, if you remember. And it sort of struck me that actually, why am I going back to Europe where they've got COVID really badly when I could be staying here and they've got real controls in place and actually things are quite good? But somebody said, you know, you need to go back because if you catch it here, you will be in trouble. Whereas if you catch it in the UK, you'll probably be all right. And we were all very worried about the care and goodness knows what. So I bought a flight, which was then cancelled by Air France, and I was evacuated by the embassy and told to get out and come back later. I thought I'd be away for 3 months, but in fact, I was away for 2 years, obviously. And in the meantime, a chap I'd never met before, an ex-soldier who was working for the mayor of Freetown, said, "Don't worry, I'll look after your vehicle while you're away." And his driver would keep it, the oils pumped up, the tires under control. And people like that, just they had no need to help me, but they just did. They had space. Yeah, no problem. I'll look after your vehicle. And that's what he did. So 2 years later, I went out and picked it up and carried on. But in that 2 years, I refined what I was doing. And that's when I focused on Parkinson's Africa. I know the cure Parkinson's people pretty well. And they introduced me to somebody called Omotola Thomas, who runs Parkinson's Africa. And she said, she told me people I could meet along the way and the good work that was being done by so many people and arranged a bit of an itinerary. And I then started to focus on the realities of having Parkinson's in a place where there's no provision to look after people. And that for me is really my driver at the moment, because we're very well looked after in this country. We're very lucky. And the amount the NHS spends on us is huge. And anybody who complains about the NHS is, well, they obviously haven't got a problem. A waiting list here is nothing compared to a waiting list in Africa where there's no provision at all. There are very few neurologists, there are very few drugs, and you've got to pay for what you get. There's no system to look after people. And in some places, there's a stigma attached to it, and it's all to do with witchcraft because people can't explain it. Parkinson's is a sort of disease that there's no cause, there's no reason why people have it, or they don't understand why they've got it. It manifests itself in really horrible ways, and there's no cure. And people say, well, we don't know what it is, so therefore it must be horrible, it must be witchcraft, and you must be cursed. You've done something wrong. And people think it's contagious, so they therefore isolate themselves and are isolated by their families. And people are left to rot, effectively, and just die a very, very slow, miserable death. And that's what it is, effectively. They just gradually sort of don't eat, and they don't look after themselves, and they don't get out. And they don't wish to live any longer. There's an example. We spent time in Uganda. I flew back out. This chap, Hannington, his mother died after having it for 5 years. And every day she would pray to die. And she was just wishing that it was all over. And it didn't have to happen. And Hannington didn't know that it was Parkinson's at the time because they didn't know what it was. And he'd been told that she was cursed, and the rest of the family had to stay away because the whole place was cursed. And he kept going back to see her and was horrified by what was happening. He looked up the internet what it was, and it was so obvious. He said she had Parkinson's. And he then started to raise awareness of Parkinson's and say, it's not magic. It's not black magic. It's not witchcraft. It's just a straightforward neurological condition. And people can be cared for. And by caring for people and looking after people and just loving them and doing all the things they need to do can save people's lives and make their life worth living. Because that's not happening in some places. And it costs nothing.
I think that's the really interesting point, isn't it? Is, you know, again, I noticed early on in the conversation you spoke about how if you take the drugs, it's manageable to an extent, this disease. Whereas if you don't take the drugs,
it's more than manageable. It's more than manageable. If you take the drugs, if you saw me on a good moment, you would never in a million years assume I had anything wrong with me at all. It wouldn't cross your mind. You'd think, what is he whinging about? But if you saw me when I'm at a low point, when I'm lying on the floor and couldn't move, you'd think I was. You'd wonder what on earth was going on, and because it takes it out of you. You don't tend to go out and about when you're feeling at a low ebb, and you don't advertise what it's like, and people don't get to know unless they live with people with Parkinson's and they see it firsthand. And even people who live with it don't know what's going on in people's minds. Yeah. They see people at their worst, and they see people trembling and goodness knows what, but they can't. they can only barely imagine the frustration and the psychological load that comes with this, and that's what we need to talk about a bit.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's exactly it. It's the difference between the provision of medicine, which is a whole, you know, that's one conversation, but then that, I don't like the phrase raising awareness, but the raising awareness of the disease in places like Africa, where, you know, so that we can stop people being isolated and accused of, you know,
I agree with you about raising awareness. Let's call it education. If we tell people it's not a curse. You have done nothing wrong. It is a straightforward neurological condition. This is why you can't do what you need to do. There are drugs. They might not be available to you right now, but actually, just by living as happily as you can, you're not to blame. People can look after you. They can still feed you. They can still dress you. They can still get a glass of water for you. They can prop you up in bed. All these things. Whereas beforehand, and it's happening in many places, they don't think they can do that because they're worried about catching it themselves.
So what? Why did it change for you? You know, obviously you've got your 2 years at home through COVID, but why did your motivation change?
Because people showed an interest in what I was doing. I met Rob Haywood, who's the filmmaker who works for New Fruit in Bristol, at lunch. And he said, I showed him my phone with some pictures of the vehicle trundling through the desert. And he went, wow, that's really cool. Can I make a film? I went, yeah, do whatever you like, sort of thing. Come and join me. And so we sort of set up this partnership, and he came out four or five times, and we were going to make a film to show what it was like for me to have Parkinson's and travel, and what it was like to meet people with Parkinson's along the way. And it was, and because of Parkinson's Africa and some of the introductions we got, it was very powerful stuff. And if you haven't seen the films, I'll send you some links and you'll see, and it's powerful, powerful stuff. And so I was convinced that I could not make a big difference, but I could draw attention to this, and a tiny amount of money would make a big difference. Just paying for people to go on a taxi ride to a meeting where they meet other people, where paying for some photocopying to put up some notices saying, don't worry, it's not contagious, I am not cursed, that sort of thing, costs nothing, but they haven't even got that much money to do it.
Yeah. So what did
Because people don't, there's not much homework being done because people assume it's a curse. And governments don't know the size of the problem. They don't know how many people have got Parkinson's disease. They have no idea. So therefore, they're not prepared to invest money in it. And I don't blame them either. They've got other things. They've got malaria and they've got Ebola and goodness knows what. Why should they invest in something that they don't know much about?
So what did you do then? I mean, there's, you know, you've done the first part of your journey. You've had your 2 years at home. You go back out there. What's the plan now?
To go and see, to meet as many people along the way as I could, and to film them and be filmed with them so I could draw attention to the plight of people who've got it, to meet people who are doing something about it, and to praise and to trumpet the work that some organisations are doing in Africa. And there are some great organisations doing some fantastic things who are making a really big difference, but they're it's not throughout the continent, it's in isolated areas. Fantastic stuff. And to make a film and bring it back to the UK and show people what is going on.
Yeah. I have to say, you know, earlier you said Parkinson's makes you selfish. It sounds like it's made you selfless.
When you've got nothing to lose, then you play the whole game. This is like a job of work for me. And what else can I do? I can't do anything else. I can't do a proper job of work. This is it, really. And every moment of the day, I'm thinking, how can I get the word out to more people? And some of which will give a bit of money, and we'll be able to do a bit of advertising and do some campaigns in Africa. But it's all about educating people, and I can't describe it. It's so simple. We all need drugs because it makes a big difference. We all would love to have a cure, but that's not happening quite yet. But it might happen quite soon. The whole world wants a cure. Drugs make a big difference. But actually what really makes a difference is being cared for and being respected and being loved. And that requires a bit of education. That's all it takes. And it costs nothing.
No, that's a very good speech. I completely hear you. Yeah. So
that's what I was going to do is... It's not quite your Diana and age sort of type thing, but it's the same sort of idea, you know.
No, I think it's brilliant in lots of ways, and you know, I'm really interested in your psychology, because it sounds like this journey was something you'd always wanted to do for you, justifiably, adventure for the sake of adventure,
entirely selfish.
Yeah, but not in a bad way. I'm often keen to champion that, you know, we're allowed to go on adventures for ourselves because we want to.
Yeah.
I think that we should protect that at all costs. But after COVID, you know, when you flew back out, it seems like your purpose had completely changed. Did that affect your enjoyment of the overland journey?
No, but to be honest, if I'm really, really honest, the overland journey is not as much fun as people think it is, because you're doing a lot of driving and you're doing a lot of speed bumps and you're doing a lot of checkpoints and you're doing a lot of faffing around, making sure you've got enough cash, making sure your SIM card hasn't got, you know, whatever happens. It's a lot of boring things. All you're doing is filling your passport up with stamps, which is you can boast about in the pub when you come back. And you have some photographs of the van in yet another muddy road. You know, it's not as glamorous as it sounds. What is great about it is and this is what I love about these overland trips. On a daily basis, the scenery changes, the people change, the music changes, the food changes, the environment changes as you're traveling, and you get to see this country sort of growing around you until you end up in the forests of Gabon and Benin and all those sort of places. And then you're back out into Angola, which that's not the Sahel, but it's become semi-arid again. Then you're in the deserts of Namibia. And you think, I've done all that. I've seen all these environments in the space of a year unfolding in front of my eyes. The windscreen is like a big projector screen.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's two arguments, aren't there? And that neither are right or wrong. There's the whole, you know, slow travel conversation about the beauty of slow travel, but then there's also the fast travel, you know, getting from place to place and seeing it all change. And a journey of that length is going to be very different to an on foot journey of 3 months, but no less or no less more valid.
I would do it again, and I'd do it in the same way, with almost exactly the same way, with a few things I've learned along the way, of course. But I would do the same thing again, because you meet so many people, and every adversity, every problem is an opportunity to make another story and have an interesting time. And there wasn't an occasion when I had a disaster which didn't turn out to be a blessing in a funny sort of way.
Well, and if I can ask, how did your, you know, as you say, you're very mechanically minded and you spent your career in the army, you know, working with machines and vehicles, but how did your Parkinson's affect your ability to be self-sufficient and make your own repairs and make your own food, etc.?
God, it's deeply frustrating. If you asked me to change a plug, it would take me about a week to do it. You know, I honestly, that sort of thing is deeply frustrating, but I'm quite stubborn and I'll jolly well try. I just basically spend a lot of time doing things which should take me no time at all to do. There was one case, this is so typical of me, and I'm sure I hope other people are in the same boat. I was just travelling through Senegal, and they have quite good roads in Senegal, and they have payages and that sort of stuff, which doesn't sound very exciting when you're travelling through Africa to be on a payage, but there you go. And I stopped in the payage to pay my dues, and I noticed smoke coming out of the vehicle. I thought, oh my God, disaster. And liquid pouring out of the front. I thought, this is not good. So I pulled over the little lay-by just after the barrier and looked underneath. I thought, oh my God, this is not good. And so I have bash plates underneath. This is about 7 o'clock in the evening, of course. Everything happens in the evening when it's just about to get dark or getting dark. And I thought, well, I better examine this and find out what's going on. So I took the bash plate off, which is quite a heavy thing. And I've got Parkinson's, remember? So this lump of metal sort of fell on me, which is fine. And I got out of the way. I thought, that's great. And I found the liquid that was pouring out of the bottom, and I couldn't work out where it's coming from. And it turned out, of course, it was the condensation overflow from the air conditioning I'd had on. And I thought, fucking hell. Sorry. I've got all this effort getting this bloody great steel plate off. If I just thought about it, I would have noticed it was the air conditioning condensation. And the smoke at the back, which I didn't know at the time, there are two air conditioners on a T5 California, one at the back, one at the front, and the overflow, the condensation from the rear one was dripping onto the exhaust pipe. And when I stopped at the payage barrier, there was lots of water coming out. That's why it looked like smoke. Anyway, I thought, well, I better put it back on again and get ready to go. And it's only 6 bolts after all, but it's quite heavy and it's dark. And I have lots of torches and lots of lights. And you have to line it up and everything. And it took me until about 4 o'clock in the morning. And on two occasions, the equivalent of an AA man came along and said, "You're right." I said, "No, I'm absolutely fine, thank you. I'm absolutely fine." And eventually, the second time he came along, I said, "If you could help, that would be really good." He put it on about 10 minutes.
But I do understand it. I understand this need to want to do it yourself, you know, kind of against the odds.
I loaded the vehicle in a way, and I took stuff that my general rule of thumb was, if I can't do it by myself, I shouldn't be doing it at all. So every bit of kit I had to be manageable by me. So I wanted subliminally to prove that was the case, I suppose, and that was the case. Everything I could do by myself, apart from change a clutch, which I had to go to a garage for twice.
I'm very conscious of time. There's lots of things I could ask you, but where did your journey end and when?
Well, I thought we could spend an hour talking about that as well. The journey hasn't ended. That's the first thing. But the trip that I got to Cape Town in December, beginning, end of November, 2022 would be, wouldn't it? I think 2022. And it was a funny, I had Rob in the car with me filming, and you'd expect it to be a great champagne and sirens and hooters and whooping and all that great sort of ceremony, but not a bit of it. I was deflated and elated. I was delighted I'd got there and the vehicle hadn't broken down again. I was just pleased it was over. And then suddenly you think, well, that's 30 years worth of dreaming finished. A year's worth of travelling finished. All that sort of effort done. I'm now going to go back to England. What am I going to do? Where do I go from here? How do I replace this important chapter of my life? And it was of course the Parkinson's was getting worse. So therefore I had not much to look forward to. It was downhill all the way in that respect too. So what was I going to do? And it was a very deflatory moment actually. There was a tear in my eye.
Yeah, again, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, the post-expedition blues. I think, I don't want to sound elitist in any way, but it's one of those things that unless you've experienced it, you almost can't understand what it's like, where, there, you know, it's like mountaineering. You know, the summit of mountains is very rarely spectacular. Sometimes it is, but the majority of the time, and this is the cliche, and it's an awful cliche, but it's the journey, not the summit. You know, you get to the summit, you're tired, it's foggy, you go, right, we've got that one, off we go. Down we go. It's a long way home. And that's that. And it is, well, what do we do now? Okay, we've done the thing. That's it.
Well, what I'm doing now is I've been busier than I was in the army in a funny sort of way. Because we're making a film. I've written this book. I'm telling the world as much as I can that what we're doing and making the point that all the messaging about Parkinson's is getting out and about, and I'm planning on doing more if I can.
When you said the journey isn't over, do you mean metaphorically or literally? Is there a, are you going to get back in?
I mean both. If I'm trying to get BW to be generous to me, and if they were, I would drive back up the East Coast. Well, not the East Coast necessarily, because the East Coast is a bit dodgy up to north of Kenya, but up the eastern side. Yeah. And then cross over the Red Sea to Saudi Arabia and up to Jordan and beyond. That's what I'd like to do. But to do that, I must recognise that I'm not as fit as I used to be. I certainly have to have an automatic vehicle, which would be a really good thing. But it's not impossible. And that's my ultimate goal. And if I can't do that, then I'll just go around the Balkans or something like that. But the aim is to, everything I do should be about raising awareness, and I should be doing it for a purpose rather than just drifting along.
Yeah, well, it sounds wonderful. I mean, I hope you manage to do both or either. That might be worth a conversation offline. Well, we are slightly over time, but I always end these conversations with the same two questions and then ask them of you now. The first is, what scares you?
Scared me?
What scares you?
What does scare me now? What scares me? I don't want to die painfully. But I'm not scared of dying.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. What brings you hope?
The extraordinary people I met along the way. We have a lot to learn in this country. And it might be to do with the weather, and it might be to do with the fact we all live in villages with doors and fires and goodness knows what, and we go home to our own houses. But I met so many people along the way who, with nothing at all, did so much to help me, whether it be helping me in the mud, helping push the vehicle, having me to stay in the houses. When I was not capable of driving on a couple of occasions because I was a bit worn out, then there's one case, in Congo, the Republic of Congo, I'd crossed over from Gabon, driven down this unmade road, arrived in a place called Deluze, I think it's Deluize, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it actually, never did work out. And we got to a petrol station, which are all quite modern, filled up with petrol, and I said to the attendant, you know, the girl who's in the shop, would you mind if I just stayed in your car park and had a bit of a kip, put the roof up and just relax? She said, no, not at all. She recognised I was stumbling around like an old git. She said, are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm fine, I'm fine. She said, well, why don't you have the shower and use our facilities and everything like that and get yourself washed down and everything. I said, that's really kind. So I did all that. And then she said, where are you going to? I said, well, I haven't decided yet. I said, I'm probably Point Noir. She said, well, let me get my brother. He'll drive you down there. So she got hold of her brother. He came up and he drove me in my van down to the Point Noir and made sure I got in the right place and the rest of it and was looked after. Another occasion when I hit a pothole and damaged the suspension so badly I couldn't drive. The first car that came along was obviously in a pickup, reasonably sort of smart, middle class, white shirt and everything. Said, are you all right? And I said, well, actually, not really. I can't move. And he went, oh, dear. He stopped. And he and the next driver who stopped as well in a big Arctic truck spent 9 hours with me getting the vehicle mobile again and being able to drive it to the next village where they made sure I was in capable and safe hands and I was looked after and I was in the right place. I then went from there down to Libreville, leaving the vehicle in this bush mechanic's yard with everything inside it, you know, couldn't do anything else because I wanted to go meet Rob and get some filming. And the chap who was sharing the taxi with me, the taxi was stopped by a police point because their paperwork wasn't right. We spent the night in the police station. And this fellow who was with me came with me in the next minibus to the hotel we're going to make sure I got to the right place, dropped me off with Rob, said, thank you very much, everything all right, and disappeared, never saw him again. And people are just incredibly kind, incredibly kind.
Isn't that, you know, I know I've asked my two last questions, but I think, and I you know, I've spent a lot of time in Africa, but I think the misconception is that this is a dangerous journey, you know, and in some ways it is, of course. There are political and, you know, human risks, essentially, which are some of the scarier risks on adventures, I think. But every time I hear a story like this, I'm overwhelmed by the, actually, it's the opposite is often true.
Quite the opposite. You would spend longer waiting on the side of the M4 for the AA to come and pick you up than the amount of help I received when I needed it. Incredibly kind people were. Incredibly kind. If I tell you about Mohammed, who mended my differential in Morocco for almost no money at all, he said he was leaving Andorra the next week and said, I'll see you in Morocco. And I went, all right, not thinking very much about it. The way in which we met up was extraordinary. But we met up very easily, and I went and had lunch with his father and mother. He wanted to show off his big friend for England, sort of thing, I suppose. And I was feeling a bit knackered. And he said, "You're tired." I said, "Well, it's all right." And they made a bed up for me in their living room. So I said, "You must rest." So I said, "Oh, I must rest." And I guess so I rested. And then I had lunch, and he was putting food on my fork for me and feeding me by hand. This old boy who was 60 years old or whatever, maybe it might have been 70, but he was a truck driver who'd never had an accident in his truck driving career, and he was feeding me by hand.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. Well, there you go. I mean, what a positive way to end an episode. Human kindness, we can rely on it.
It's amazing. And My only regret is that I can't repay them in the way that I'd like to. And the result is I've vowed to myself that if ever I get the opportunity to help anybody do anything, I will say yes.
Well, I mean, at risk of sounding trite, I think you're doing more than enough to repay the kindness debt, so I wouldn't worry too much.
Well, people are incredibly... I arrived to stay with somebody, got off an aeroplane, didn't know it at the time, couldn't get off the aeroplane because I threw up on the plane, was feeling sick and very unwell for whatever reason, assumed it was Parkinson's. This chap I'd never met before said, "Are you all right?" I said, "No." I said, "Would you mind just helping me with my bag?" And he said, "No, not at all, at all." Took me through the customs, everything. I then got into the car of a chap called Angus Mackey, who I'd heard of through a mate, and he said, "Let me stay for a couple of days." And I arrived with malaria on his doorstep. And he put me to bed for 4 days, and I was got the drugs, and I was absolutely, he saved my life. I'd never met him before in my life.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. Well, I suppose we should end by saying... there's a book.
Oh, there is a book. Yes, there's a book.
And what is it called, and when is it out?
good point. There's a book called Running on Empty, and it's fairly obviously called Running on Empty because it refers to the lack of dopamine. Although there was a song called Running on Empty by Jackson Brown, which is a great song, but that's another story altogether. And it comes out on World Parkinson's Day, which is on the 11th of next month.
Amazing. Okay. That's the, wait, I'm not sure when we release this, so that's the 11th of April, Running on Empty.
And it's a good read, a ripping read, and not one penny of it goes to me, it all goes to charity.
Oh, well, there you go. How could we not, how could the entire audience not buy it?
Exactly that. And better still, you haven't even got a movie, you get an audio version.
It's all there.
It's all there.
Amazing. Well, we'll leave it there, Guy. Thank you so much.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, then you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience.